You're listening to Donuts and Top Cow.
Two great tastes that taste better together. But today, there's no tasting.
Welcome to episode 26 of Donuts and Top Cow. My name is John Grigas.
And I'm Josh Crawley.
And we are here at the beautiful retail location of Westfield Comics. Located on the east side of Madison on Williamson Street, there's also a second retail outlet opened at Mineral Point Road in Madison. You can do business online with Westfield Comics at www.westfieldcomics.com for two-year-door service, subscription service, and a handy 20% discount online. So, Josh, you're right. We have no donuts today.
Just means we can talk all about Top Cow.
It is, and we have a lot of Top Cow to talk about. We'll start with Top Cow news from San Diego Comic-Con. As you may have heard on our last episode, we did talk about it last episode, but then it got lost in a technology blunder. Well, yeah. it's Microsoft Vista, so technology blunder is probably an accurate description.
I like Windows 7 well enough anyways. I use it here at work.
Yeah, so far not too bad, but I didn't have it on my laptop. So instead, we invested in a digital recorder for a little added stability, and this is our first episode recorded on that recorder.
Sometimes all-in-one is not the way to go, people.
So San Diego Comic-Con was, based on what I saw long distance, it looks like it was a successful con for Top Cow. They had several panels and some pretty interesting news. The first news was their first panel, which was the Darkness 2 video game. And they noted that the new game story picks up where the old Darkness video game left off. It'll be available on Xbox 360 and PlayStation. And they gave a release date of February 7th, 2012, which is a few months after the most recent release date, which was about early to mid-November of this year. So disappointed that it's delayed, but still looking forward to playing it.
That'll give me time to get my game thumbs a workout, get them in shape.
Yeah, that's I'm looking for that.
I can not win another video game.
I don't know that I've ever been through a whole video game anyway to solve the whole thing, but we're going to give this one a shot. And in fact, we're going to I think I'm going to pick up the first Darkness video game and get a little just a little practice in before that happens. I know that it's not necessarily being produced right now, but eBay's got a few I might check out and check it out. But when we do get the new Darkness 2 video game, which we will be buying, we're also going to have a little Darkness 2 tournament for anybody who is a listener in the Madison area or who can get to the Madison area. We're going to have a little Darkness 2 party.
Sweet.
And then the next panel was about the pilot season project, Top Cow's 2011 pilot season initiative. As we mentioned on last episode, I'm going to mention it again. We are going to have a review of it probably in our next episode because there are eight titles that are coming out as part of the Top Cow 2011 pilot season, and we want to kind of preview those, so we'll walk through each of them. A lot of familiar names in the creators, some new names in the creators, and it looks like a pretty fun lineup for the next lineup of pilot season. That gets us to what I think is the biggest news of the San Diego Comic-Con, and that's Artifacts is going to be an ongoing series.
Oh, yeah.
Starting with number 14, and the additional news, which is, I don't know, is easy to understand, so it's kind of like non-news news, is that Ron Mars will stay on as the writer of Artifacts, but Stefan Sajic is coming over from Witchblade after 150. To start up with Artifacts 14.
And I think I maybe called that with the non-team team book, because I don't know what else a title like Artifacts with all those people could be.
And how can you see that going forward?
maybe some people keep some artifacts, some people lose some artifacts, and they're scattered across the globe, and there has to be adventuring going on. Or maybe some new artifacts are birthed after some other ones are destroyed. I would use the Spear of Destiny as an example, but that would kind of throw a wrench in the plans probably for the Magdalena ongoing series.
Ah, yes. Which is good, because Ron is pretty much committed to saying that Magdalena ongoing series is a big priority of his moving forward.
It would seem pointless leaving Witchblade and then for, you know, a workload reason and then canceling a book that he was also on. So,
right. We're looking forward to both, but... and we're looking forward to that. I think that it'll be interesting to see how they move out of Artifacts 13, with the only trouble being now it's a spoiler to the world. It doesn't appear is going to end the way we know it. But then the question is, does the survivor continue to survive, or is there a new survivor? Because I've always thought that Patrick Gleason could be the new curator. Maybe he'll be the new survivor.
Not to be a total ass, but I kind of want Patrick to bite it. It seems fitting.
We're kind of rooting for that, I think. I don't know.
It would be a good bookend to Ron's run on Witchblade.
It is kind of interesting, and I see where you're talking about there, and I've got some more comments about Patrick Gleason as we do our main deal on this week's episode. We're going to look at Volume 2 of the Witchblade trades, and there's a lot more Patrick Gleason development in there. I'm actually liking him a little. I'm starting to like him a lot more in this second one. Although as time's gone on, I've liked him a lot less, so we'll have to talk a little bit about that dynamic. And then the other news that was reiterated in the panel was that the creative team for Witchblade is changing up to it'll be Tim Seeley and artist Diego Bernard and Fred Bennis starting on issue 151. They also announced that Sarah is going to move to Chicago. And
spoiler.
Yeah, it is kind of a spoiler. It's in a press release, so I guess it is also out there. But but here's the quote, and this was on the Top Cow website when they were wrapping up what their panel content was the phrase that she will depart from most of the Top Cow universe to pursue her own dark fantasy and crime noir storylines.
Not as artifact-y related, I'm guessing, is probably generally what that means. I can't imagine she's going to an all-new reality. Unless, that just popped into my head. What if at the end of Artifacts, Sarah Pizzini dies and is reborn in a new parallel reality?
That is an interesting.
So part of Artifacts is finding the Witchblade,
which is on Earth 2 now.
Earth capital I.
Whether and maybe there's another incarnation of the Savage Dragon working in the police force there.
No, that'd be a little too weird, I think.
Because he's, well, I don't know, and this is maybe another spoiler, but I know with after the Emperor Dragon, he's gone now, isn't he?
Yes and no. I think there's lots of them in lots of parallel realities, so at this point I don't think it really... I mean, the dragon that was in the original book, as far as I know, is, yes, dead. But there are other dragons out there.
Fascinating. Well, I'm reading Savage Dragon in the what do they call those? The archive edition. So there's only been two out, so I'm many years behind. And
the third one has been it was originally solicited
like a year or two ago, wasn't it?
I want to say it was solicited before we moved the West Side store to its current location, which was 3.5 years ago.
It was a wild. I know that I had pre-ordered it from an online store and then had that canceled on me. So in any case, I know that it hasn't been easy to transfer those issues over to the black and white format, but maybe we'll pull it back to Top Cow. Next on our, so pretty interesting information from that. We'll see how those things unfold. Next, I know that Josh, you've got a few shout outs you'd like to extend.
But before that, I was look at this, I'm cutting off my own doing things. Did we mention at all Jason Aaron and Mark Silvestri on Incredible Hulk?
No, we haven't talked about that. I've been avoiding that purpose. But
it's... Oh, oops.
Well, we know why you couldn't do Artifacts 13 now, I suppose.
Exactly. Just because I thought that was part of some of those random announcements, and it fits. It fits.
Sure. So
if you haven't heard yet, though I'm guessing most of you that listen probably have.
Yep, Mark Silvestri is, and I just saw, actually, Bleeding Cool just put out a better rendition of the cover for The Incredible Hulk number one and also the trailer for it. So some pretty good looking stuff.
Sweet. And yeah, I got some shout outs, which I've been remiss in giving. I think partially because I always want to keep focused on the Top Cow part of things and not other comic book stuff, which really, let's be honest, we need some variety. So there are a couple other podcasts out there that people I know that are really cool do. Patrick from Challengers Comics and Conversation, who does, him and Dal do the Contest of Challengers podcast. They mentioned me a little bit in their post-Summit City Comic-Con episode, as did Avi and Molly Jane from Comic Slumber Party. More people that I drank with at Summit City Comic Con. So check out their podcasts. They're
great.
We'll
put some links in the show notes to those podcasts, too, if you want to check them out. Also, since we're doing shout-outs, I do want to give a shout-out. Basically, we appreciate you as our listeners because we have a lot of fun going through these Top Cow books. We have a lot of fun reading and getting ready for these shows and doing this. So that's been great. And it's been amazing that you've been listening and following, and I hope that you'll increase your interest in the Top Cow books and in the Top Cow universe as well. But I do want to give a shout-out. Our marketing plan, basically, for this podcast in the last, 10 or 20 episodes, seems to have been posted on Twitter, and we can count on Ron Mars to retweet it. So we do want to thank Ron for retweeting our links. If you're interested in Top Cow books, please give us a listen. And, well, I guess you did, because you're listening now.
Thanks, Ron.
And now we can move on to Witchblade Volume 2. Last week we looked at the Volume 1, which is basically the modern release of the Witchblade series, starting with Issue 80. Now we're looking at Witchblade Volume 2, and under the old series, it also was the last of the original run of Witchblade trades, because I'm holding Volume 11, which corresponds with the reissue Volume 2. And that covers Witchblade Issues 86 through 92. And I love this trade. I tell you, if you skip the last one, regardless of the $5 price, if you get a chance to pick up Volume 2, you get a value. This is a really thick trade. It's got some great stories in it. And if you're not really familiar with the Witchblade, I think you'll be really satisfied with this book.
If it was a Marvel or DC or Dark Horse trade, it would probably be a good $5 more expensive than it is, which is a retail price of $14.99 for those 7 issues.
Yeah, you're looking at a trade that's well over 180 pages, and there's just some really great content here. It's not one story arc included. That's one thing to know. It includes a couple of different stories. It includes some other things that Ron has introduced yet again that we'll start walking through. And then it ends up with a real useful issue, one of my favorites, really, of the whole Witchblade run, and that's issue 92, where Ron tells the origin of the Witchblade, and not the Sarah Pazzini origin, but the origin of the Witchblade itself, and a lot of rich content in there.
The origin of the balance.
Yeah. And now, I guess I'm getting ahead of myself, but it is called by the curator, it's called the balance. Is that the first instance that we've seen it called that?
I believe so, yes.
So Volume 2 of the trade opens up with Issue 86. And in it, like I say, we won't talk much about the stories, but about some key elements that might mean something to you if you're following, say, the Artifact series or the latest Witchblade issues. And in here, Sarah is called to a museum to investigate some strange going-ons and a murder, and she ends up struggling with a suit of samurai armor that is possessed by a ghost, because there's no body in it, but this armor is fighting with what appears to be the blood sword. Would you say that's the introduction of that here?
I certainly hope so, since the title of the story appears to be Blood Sword.
Very good. So Sarah defeats this ghostly presence, And she gets the background of it and lets us know a little of the origin of the blood sword by grabbing the sword with the witchblade, with her witchblade hand. And it transports her mind to the origin of it and in how it was wielded by its lord in battle. And before the Sword of Blood, he was invincible, except to treachery from those closest to him. And it kind of runs through the original wielder of the Blood Sword until she's brought back into modern times. The Witchblade's able to vaporize this soul from and eliminate him from the Blood Sword as he flies away and is able to take it over from the armor. And she comes into possession of it.
And you wouldn't have to be a keen-eyed reader to notice this, as I'm going to completely explain it now. But there is a passing reference to the Family Ties storyline crossover between Witchblade and Darkness from way, way back in the day. I want to say Witchblade issues like 9 and 10 or 10 and 11 in Darkness, maybe 7 and 8. Collected, I believe, in Darkness Origins Volume 2 and possibly Witchblade Origins Volume 2. Both. Yeah, because there was stuff that involved destruction of dinosaur skeletons and whatnot, and animation of dinosaur skeletons that may be the reassembled skeleton that we see in the background a few panels here. But I thought it was a fun little tidbit to throw in.
Yeah, that's cool. Sarah takes the sword to somebody who may be able to explain, and we return to the curator's shop. He starts to show up more regularly now since his introduction in Witchblade 80. He recognizes the sword. He explains that it's the Katsuma no Katana, and it is. He tells Sarah, "You were right to bring it here. This blade is known to me." And he adds that at its forging, a shaman summoned up a demon and captured its essence and shackled it to the blade. And basically, the sword craves carnage. And we've seen that all the way through, that the wielder of the sword doesn't necessarily have control of what the sword does, because the sword just aches for blood.
Which is really dangerous when you give it to someone who also wants to take blood. Ian Nottingham. Not so much Patrick Gleason.
Not so much who will end up wielding it for a brief time. But in any case, Sarah leaves and leaves the sword in the possession of the curator, who has a case and holder just set right for it. So he places it on display, and I'm sure that we will be seeing it later. That moves on to Witchblade 87, and the artwork was, I don't know, it was, I guess, unremarkable by Q Cha and inks by Jay Leaston. It was serviceable and it was fine. But I didn't really notice how it was until this issue 87, when Chris Pagello came in. And I thought that this was a beautiful issue.
Chris does some pretty, pretty, pretty work.
Yeah, very expressive, really good panel layouts and angles. And I really enjoyed this one. This one had a little mystical kind of murder mystery that starts in there. It's pivotal, I guess, from a Sarah Pazzini Witchblade history standpoint, is that this is the issue where she gets her papers to get transferred downtown to One Police Plaza as a special investigator. And we first hear about Captain Peru, and we don't see her, but we hear that that's who she's going to be in charge of. We also see Gleason again as she's moving her stuff out of her old digs and into the new One Police Plaza. She's not happy to see him. She blames him for the transfer. And
love that page.
Yeah, just opened a page where there's a string of mystery murders, and it turns out to be some, I don't know, they're kind of like Haunted Mansion-type ghouls. They're definitely not living. They don't seem to be zombies, but they seem to be like ghosts and zombies and some other kind of ghouls all mixed together. Maybe a little Jacob Marley with the chains. And they appear and disappear, and they're taking care of some of these homeless or wayward souls. Sarah encounters them and immediately invokes the Witchblade, and that's the panel that Josh is referring to.
On that page turn. But the page before, she at some point... Oh, maybe she didn't. I could have sworn she did. I thought there was one panel. Oh, yeah, it's right there, isn't it? She actually takes her jacket off before busting out the Witchblade action.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Which is nice. Like, you know, I don't want to ruin my awesome jacket because it would have happened otherwise. She's showing a little care.
It is a nice leather jacket, and that makes sense because, you know, how many times you see, whether it's the Incredible Hulk or whether it's the Witchblade, you see all these clothes being shredded all the time when they invoke their powers. So she takes the jacket off, and out comes the Witchblade. It's a great panel if you get to see it, but it's Sarah basically at a three-quarters pose with the Witchblade engulfing around her but not enveloping her yet, and she just says, "You're coming with me," to take them in. Naturally, they escape, so the mystery continues. But then again, in this issue, we get the introduction of kind of going back a little bit as she takes out her... as she gets her office, we introduce probably the character that Ron Mars has introduced that I hate the most, that if I had to pick one character to be killed, it would be this character. And that's the parrot that's in her office when she walks in.
I thought you were going to talk about the janitor from her old police precinct. I completely forgot about the parrot.
I hate that parrot, and I'm glad that it hasn't shown up a whole lot in recent issues. But if you're not...
The parrot's good comic relief.
Well... it's formulaic comic relief, really. He does kind of play a role coming up in a little bit, but man, I hate that parrot.
I think he's a good icebreaker when, because you know, there's some dark stuff happens in the book, and every so often, you know, a little potty humor.
Well, that's
not
what the parrot's good
humor,
for.
But,
so, well,
yeah.
Kind of though, because well, I guess a little sexual harassment humor maybe.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
This is a parrot that is left behind in the office. That immediately preceded Sarah in the office, kind of left a mess and also left this parrot who's fairly filthy mouthed and propositions Sarah quite a bit and says some things. And it's just one of those, you just shake your head and go, when is she going to kill this parrot? And it somehow it stays on for a while. So we'll keep moving on with that. The next issue, now we're back to Michael Choi and Sam Regla on the art and back to the familiar style that we got used to in the volume one of the trade.
Did you just say Sam Regla?
Yeah, didn't I?
Sal.
Whoops.
I was just like, wait, did I really hear that? And then I was just going to let it go, and then I was like, no.
Nope.
No, I'm not going to let it go.
Did. That's my bad penmanship. Sal Regla, who did the inking. And we meet Captain Peyrou here. I'm not sure how to say that last name, but P-E-Y-R-O-U-X.
I think I would go with Peyrou.
All right, Captain Peyrou, who is Samantha Peyrou, so it's a woman, and that's another twist here. So we have a woman working for a woman on the police force. And Sarah is investigating a kidnapping case in this one, who happens to be, as Josh mentioned, the janitor of her old precinct, became a good friend of Sarah's, and she's the grandmother of a girl who has come up missing. So the next couple of issues are about her finding Keisha, her granddaughter, and trying to find out. There is an interchange that I found was important because by this time Patrick Gleason is pretty much partnered up with her, and this is where the Gleason and Pizzini dynamics start to build. And he is aware of the Witchblade now by this time. And they're trying to look for the girl. They have very little clues. They have got questionable sources, some of them which lie, some of them which tell the truth. And Gleason asks her to try the Witchblade, to see if the Witchblade can find it. And for the first time, except when really walking into battle, you see her really concentrating to try to make the Witchblade do something. The Witchblade kind of comes to life, but it can't help. She basically says the Witchblade can protect, it can heal, but it can't find this missing girl, or, you know, can't find other things.
And actually, right after that, we get a couple-page interlude, which will deal with the next three issues story immediately following this partner's story. And after that, for what's just about the last... 2/5 of the book, there's a new colorist. Ooh.
That is true.
We don't get Brian B. We get Fidcakes. That would be Chad Fiddler. And I think the most noticeable thing is, while the rendering is similar, the palette seems a bit different. And I like it quite a bit. And I would actually have to go to people smarter than I. Yes, yes, it is possible. Despite what I may act like sometimes. But the palette looks similar to the palette that Sonia Obak ends up using after she starts coloring Mike Choi's stuff here at the end of this volume about four issues later.
And that's a good question. And just to kind of as a teaser for a future show, we're hoping to be able to ask an expert that question, being Chad Fiddler, because we happen to have contact
that
he's coming to town. We're going to try and get him on the show so we can talk a little bit about his experience with Top Cow and in coloring these issues in particular, this issue.
Yeah, I think he did about 9 pages in here, because he didn't do the very last page of this issue, but it looks like he did a good 9-page chunk right before the last issue. But I really like this story because it focused on them as partners, and it really was the first issue of them as actual, like, they're going to be long-term partners.
Yeah, you really got that indication.
Being assigned together, not just the, oh, hey, look, he's a fill-in partner. They're actual partners now, so.
And symbolically, Sarah visited the comatose form of Jake in the hospital. In the meantime, Jake lives on at this moment, and basically she holds his hand to say goodbye, and after he leaves, he moves his hand, so we know that we'll be seeing him at some point in the future. Another, as we move on through issues 89 and beyond, there's a developing story. She continues to investigate some gruesome crime scenes and murders, and she encounters federal investigators John Karstens and Heather McGuinn, which really are driving this series. They are investigating horrible murder scenes, and they catch up with kind of an incredible Hulk-like beast, and his origin story is very similar to a couple of characters that we've seen before. He's a soldier in the service, and they inject him with serum, and it turns him into a mad and mind-controlled beast. Sarah engages him, and we find out later on that they're in control of these two federal investigators. They're basically behind this monster. They're either tracking him down to control him, or they're, you know, performing these crimes because they have such influence over him.
Yeah, my only issue with this story is, and this is a difference, I shouldn't say a difference, rather maybe a juxtaposition of art and story, when this character's origin is actually being recounted, talking about how his purpose is in and out, targets neutralized, no survivors, no way to trace it back to the wrong people, the wrong government. And in the same panel, he's wearing an American flag bandana on his head.
So, and I always felt that it was the United States that was the government that was creating this guy, but they certainly identify themselves. John Karstens and Heather McGuinn are the two federal investigators. They're kind of like X-Files type characters. But one of them, when Sarah engages them, they get the origin story. We find out that this hulking monster is not such a bad guy. He was Lance Corporal Michael Andrews, and he pulls Sarah and Patrick Gleason more over to their, you know, they start to sympathize with him. These federal investigators show up, and then John Karstens starts to take on some sort of flaming energy of his own. So these are obviously metahumans of some sort. And they engage the Witchblade. She fights, and they first have this hulking figure fighting Sarah because he's obviously being mind-controlled. And we see a little bit of the detective skills of Patrick Gleason. He isolates with the flaming John Karstens, and the woman, Heather McGuinn, doesn't have any apparent powers. He points a gun point blank at him, and Karstens basically says to Gleason that he's a good cop. There's no way that he'll just shoot him, regardless of any perceived threat right now. And Gleason says, "You're right," and he proceeds to shoot Heather, the supposedly unpowered person, and all of a sudden the mind link to the monster is broken. He figures out through his detective work that she's the real power behind everything, with some mind control on the monster.
Yeah, but there's a... If you look at that page, though, there's other goofy mind controllingness going on. It's, because, yeah, see, like, right there, she's kind of almost like she wants... I mean, she says, please, she wants it to be over.
Yeah, this beast, he breaks her arm, he takes possession of her, he holds her head, and she says, please, and it's kind of interesting. I don't know if she's saying, like, please don't hurt me, or please kill me. One of the two is being said, but Ron just has her saying, please, and then trailing off. So he snaps her neck and kills her, and therefore ends the mental connection altogether. This beast creature then really confronts the flaming John Karstens, who is fully flaming now, but he grabs a hold of him, jumps off into the river, carries him away, and we don't see them again. They're presumed dead. But looks like the federal agency sends in another introduced character to investigate the aftermath, and we get the first time that Sarah Pazzini gets to meet Samantha Argent.
Oh, yeah.
So they have a fairly cold yet courteous meeting, a little exchange about what happened, what didn't happen. Sarah lies quite a bit in it. She doesn't really connect herself to the events going on except as a witness.
Well, figure especially at this point, she doesn't quite know what Samantha's capable of. So
that is true, and she has no good cause to trust her after what just happened with Karstens and McGuinn, who also introduced themselves as federal investigators. So, but one fun little Easter egg in here is with that damn parrot, that as Samantha Argent leaves the room, the parrot starts yelling, Argent, killer body, killer.
Yep.
So, little reference to the old hunter-killer action going on there. So that was that's a nice introduction of another Top Cow universe character from Hunter-Killer coming in, and that ends that storyline. And I'm telling you, I'll take breaks out. This trade is really worthwhile. It's worth having. You've got multiple stories. It's a really satisfying trade. And then we get to my favorite issue of the book, which is issue 92, revealing the origin of the Witchblade. And one of the cool things is, so Sarah confronts the curator, demands that she knows the origin of it, and the curator comes and says, you know, once you learn this, you can't unlearn it. Comes to Sarah and puts his hand near the Witchblade, and the Witchblade immediately starts to react, which is unique.
Well, I would say the way it reacts is unique. Because I could, you know, say someone with a negative intent towards the Witchblade were to approach it, it would probably react in some way.
Yeah,
defensively.
Unfolding tentacles, but almost in a really almost gentle way it's being drawn, which is kind of interesting. But then it runs basically backwards through time to the origin of the Witchblade, which is awesome. And what makes it awesome is in each of these double page spreads of the Witchblade incarnation, they're done by different artists, and it's like a who's who of comic art that are taking care of these things. We have, just to run through some of the basic ones, the first five pages are drawn by Michael Choi, pages 6 and 7 by Darwin Cook, and then Eric Basaldua, followed by Luke Ross, followed by Francis Manipole, with inks by Kevin Conrad, followed by Rodolfo Miglieri, then Brandon Peterson, Bart Sears, Terry and Rachel Dodson show up in the book. Chris Bocello comes back with inks by Tim Townsend, and Chris Bocello also does the colors for the pages he does. George Perez comes in and draws a couple of pages with inks by Mike Perkins. Joseph Michael Linsner comes in, which we'll touch base on the character that he gets to draw, with colors by Steve Furchow. Then Mark Silvestri also.
It's a character that has boobs.
Yeah, and I wonder if you might have heard of it. And then Mark Silvestri comes in before back to Michael Choi to come back to modern times to wrap up the story. But it really walks through the ages. It walks through the Witchblade in Stalingrad in 1942. It has two pages about the Witchblade wielder in Paris in 1898, and it shows that wielder meeting Kenneth Irons.
Kenneth Irons.
And it goes to the Turks and Caicos Islands in 1718. This one's a fun one with Anne Bonny, which is a... There are a couple Anne Bonny stories out there as a wielder of the Witchblade, kind of in pirate times. And on this little two-page spread, she's encountered the pirate ship named Darkness that is captained by Miguel Estacado.
Oh, Miguel.
Who throws out the quote, "The darkness is my domain." We go to Japan in 1632, Africa in 1509.
Whoa, jumping too fast. Jumping too fast.
Sorry.
I was going to point out some of the storylines / places people might have read about some of these characters, actually.
You want to start over and walk through it again?
Nah, we can just jump quick. People can hit rewind if they need to.
Okay.
Get over it. Stalingrad, so that's going to be familiar to people that have read the most recent Witchblade annual. The Anne Bonny story, I think the first one was Witchblade number 9, which would actually probably make Witchblade number 10 Darkness number 0 in the start of that Family Ties crossover. Possibly? I don't remember anymore. I believe this story in Japan may be the same character that's in the Abakimono trade, but I haven't read it yet. So, okay, we're all caught up now.
All right. Then we go to Africa in 1509.
Ooh, then the Yucatan Peninsula in 1288. And
you have Kukulkan, who is that the Angelus?
That certainly looks like it, especially since she says, "Come to me, my child." And that is quite possibly the first hint we get at as to the origin of the balance. Or the lineage, rather. Not necessarily the origin. And then we get some Bavarian Alps in 1176, which is the medieval Witchblade, as some people may know her. First appeared in that medieval Spawn Witchblade crossover way back in the day, also drawn by Brandon Peterson. So it was cool to get him back to kind of revisit the character, especially with the evolution of his artwork. It looks amazing.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And
we get to Rome in 229 with some major decadence in the Colosseum, lots of bloodlust. And it takes us back to the beginning. The first wielder of the Witchblade
is hot.
Yeah.
And has a giant saber-toothed tiger.
Definitely in control of that giant saber-toothed tiger. It is in prehistoric times and sees basically a comet crash. Why would a star fall from the sky? Come on, it's not that far. Let's find out what it is. And then we get to...
Nipples.
we get to a lot of action, and we also get some confusing kinetic art about the darkness and the Angelus and some coupling going on, and Sarah's is really interested in wondering if that's what created the Witchblade somehow. We have broken panels and lots of frenetic movement, and then it brings out to a calm state in some sort of ethereal space. You see planets in the background, you see books floating, you see a rose being picked, and somebody who introduces himself as your mother to you and so many others, although she says, "I really was just a midwife," and it's Linsner's character, Dawn.
Yes, it is.
And have you seen Dawn? Has Dawn shown up in the Witchblade at any point before this?
Not to my recollection, no. But it's a nice way to tie it all back to Image proper, Image central, which never made sense. Whenever I read a press release and they're like, "Oh, Image central," and it's not really, I mean, it's central, but there's so little there, and
that is really, yeah. It is really cool how they're connected. And then we get to the Mark Silvestri pages of what looks like it's Sarah then being having that finally explained of her origin by Dawn and then reborn in as the Witchblade in with a full-page panel that is your classic Mark Silvestri or Michael Turner Witchblade pose coming out of the coming out.
But there's a good reason. She's bursting from a Witchblade cocoon, which is recolored the Witchblade from being kind of green and gold to silver and gold so that it, I'm guessing just visually there makes for some nice differences there where you don't always have to color the armor something odd like green.
Well, it's a striking panel, and it's really a fun issue to walk through, just the different art styles that all that fit together so well, especially story-wise, but are so provocative and worth looking into. And then we're brought back to a nude Sarah Pazzini in the curator's shop, and he extends her a trench coat, just happens to be handily by nearby. We get a couple lines about being nice that she didn't have to worry about all these clothes that had been torn off of her. And somehow she seems satisfied with the explanation and walks out, and that ends our trade.
And sharp-eyed readers may want to just take a peek at the shelf above Sarah and the curator's head as they're discussing the post-origin retelling. There'll be some familiar little statues there. Visually familiar, nothing we've necessarily seen before, but
yeah, a lot of fun treasure hunt stuff in this book, as you kind of would expect it to be. The whole issue is more or less a treasure hunt, and a lot of fun and well tied together by Ron Mars. I think this is a really cool issue to hand to new readers and old readers.
And on the very last page, the curator tells Sarah Pazzini it is not her time to surrender it, not yet.
Yeah, and
bum, bum, bum.
That not yet is definitely foretelling. It's the curator alone speaking ahead, and his eyes get intense, and he says, not yet. So that brings us right up to artifacts. But there's a lot more Witchblade trades to read before then and other tie-ins that we're going to be covering as we move forward to the conclusion of the big artifacts crossover. So volume two, bottom line for me is if you're interested in knowing more about the Witchblade, this will help you learn both about Sarah Pazzini and the dynamic of her current relationships. It will let you know about the origin of the Witchblade going in through the past. Plus, there are some awesome action scenes where Sarah fights mob thugs, samurai ghosts, ghouls like New Amsterdam and Quiet Tom that we mentioned before, a Hulk-like character, some other mystical characters, and than the whole Witchblade series. So we highly recommend you pick this one up. It's a really good jumping on point. Both Volume 1 and Volume 2, as I've said before, I've liked Volume 1, but Volume 2 is really what hooked me on to wanting to read more and more Witchblade. It really hooked me onto the trades. Once I read Volume 2, then I was hungry to just pick up Witchblade trades as quick as I can read them after that.
Yes. Sorry, phone call. I don't know if I can add anything to that. I don't even remember when I actually, maybe it was when they reformatted the trades that I started reading them again regularly. That would probably be the case, because there would have been about three of them out at that point then, because the first two were kind of bang bang one after the other for the most part.
And a lot of these issues are out digitally. If you're not up for adding to your shelf space or anything like that, you can pick up these digitally. There are hundreds of Top Cow books available at another one of our sponsors, drivethroughcomics.com. It's August now, so they're done with their Christmas in July sale, but you can still get great deals on a lot of wide variety Top Cow books. There's also some reviews if you're not sure whether to buy. There's previews and a lot of other things. You can go to www.drivethroughcomics, which is thrucomics.com.
Yeah, I want to say there's, well, last time I checked, there were 20-plus free things there. So,
lots of free books, lots of free Top Cow books. Check them out. It's worth checking them
Since
out.
Since you're probably already reading at least one Top Cow book, try some more.
And on Drive-Thru Comics, they download as PDF files, so you can read them on pretty much anything. That'll do it for us today. Thanks a lot, and have a great week.
Good journey.